Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolfe. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influences their own work in some strange way. And today, I'm very excited to have writer-performer Ashley Nicole Black here. Hi.
Hello.
So lovely to see you.
Yes.
So for those of you who are less familiar with Ashley's work, please let me give you an introduction. Ashley was born in Los Angeles and grew up in Walnut, California, essentially West Covina, which we know from Song now. She took off from L.A. to attend UC Santa Cruz and graduated with a degree in theater arts. From there, she again moved away from home to Chicago, where she got a master's in performance studies at Northwestern University. She thought she wanted to get a Ph.D., but was more attracted by performing than studying, so she dropped out. After, she stayed in Chicago, gravitating towards comedy, taking improv classes at the Second City. For a time, she stayed in Chicago, writing and performing in sketches, but eventually came back to L.A. just in time to get the call from Samantha Bee that she'd be a writer and correspondent on Full Frontal with Sam Bee, which took her to New York. On the show, Ashley got to exercise both of her passions, politics and comedy, becoming the show's resident Cory Booker aficionado. In 2017, she earned an Emmy for Outstanding Writing for a Variety special for her writing on Not the White House Correspondents' Dinner Special. Altogether, she's been nominated for 6 Primetime Emmy Awards. She also appeared on Comedy Central's Drunk History before setting off on a new path, joining the cast of HBO's Black Lady Sketch Show. In her free time, she hosted the advice podcast Sip on This, which she insists will get a second season someday.
Yes.
Someday. Someday.
Someday when I have some free time.
Yes. Yes. So, with your pedigree of performance and comedy, the movie that you chose to talk about today is Get Out.
Yeah.
And could you give me a little, concise thing of why you chose this movie to talk about today?
Yeah. So you had said like an action or genre movie, and I'm like a big romantic comedy person. So there's not a ton of those movies that I've seen. There were many emails back and forth.
I was like, what about this?
Yeah. I was like, haven't seen it. And so I was like, okay, what movie can I think of that I've at least seen more than once? And Get Out was a movie that the first time I saw it, I immediately was like, I have to watch it again. And as a comedian, which Jordan is as well, there's something I think particularly that we love about things that you have to watch twice. Mm-hmm. So the first time you watch the movie, it's this terrifying horror film. And then the second time you go back and watch it, it's like a masterclass, and you're just enjoying the craft of like how they tricked you and how everything makes sense at both viewings.
Yeah.
And so that is something that I think is like unique about this film that I really love.
That's great. For those of you who haven't seen Get Out, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Get Out, you know, here's your chance. Should have done it already.
Yeah, it's on Amazon Prime. Get to it.
And now you're back, so let me introduce Get Out. Written and directed by Jordan Peele, Get Out stars Daniel Kaluuya as Chris, a Brooklyn photographer about to visit his white girlfriend Rose's parents for the first time. The two drive upstate to a small town. On the way, they hit a deer in the road, and Chris is very disturbed by the incident. Rose wants to leave the deer, but Chris calls the police. The cop proceeds to ask for Chris's license, but Rose is defensive of him and refuses to let Chris hand it over.
No, he wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving, I asked to see his ID.
Yeah, why? That doesn't make any sense.
Here.
No, fuck that. You don't have to give him your ID because you haven't done anything wrong.
Baby, it's okay, come on.
Anytime there's an incident, we have every right to ask.
Bullshit.
They go on their way and meet Dean and Missy, Rose's parents, as well as their creepy gardener, Walter, and maid, Georgina, both black. Chris can't fall asleep that night and witnesses some weird behavior from Walter and Georgina before Missy pressures Chris into hypnotherapy by stirring her spoon in her tea. Chris goes to the quote-unquote sunken place and unwittingly reveals a tragedy from his past. His mother was run over in the street, and little Chris was too scared to do anything, so he just watched TV and his mother died.
How do you feel now?
I can't move.
You can't.
Why can't I move?
You're paralyzed.
Just like that day when you did nothing. You did nothing.
The next morning, turns out hypnotherapy helped him quit smoking. Hey, that's something. But also his phone battery is dead. Georgina keeps, quote unquote, accidentally unplugging his phone.
Allow me to explain. I lifted your cellular phone to wipe down the dresser, and it accidentally came undone.
Yeah, I
rather than meddle with it further, I left it that way. How foolish of me.
Meanwhile, they prepare for a party. Dozens of wealthy white people are coming over for the festivities. And at first, all of these people act weird, but not necessarily threatening.
Fairskin has been in favor for the past, couple of hundreds of years? But now the pendulum is swung back. Black is in fashion.
But there's a young black man there, whom the audience knows to be an abductee from the first act, who confuses Chris.
Good to see another brother around here.
Yes, of course it is.
Chris tries to take a covert photo of the guy to send to his buddy, TSA agent Rod, but the flash sparks something in the guy and he seems to snap out of it and instructs Chris to...
Get out!
Chris can't take it anymore. He tries to convince Rose they have to leave, but he ends up becoming vulnerable with her and tells her about his mother. Meanwhile, the white people are holding some sort of silent auction, presumably for Chris. Chris hurries to pack his clothes, but finds a bunch of photos of Rose with former lovers, all of whom are black, including Walter and Georgina. Rose tells him she can't find her keys, and Chris is getting pretty impatient. During a standoff, the family masks slowly slip, and Chris realizes these people aren't who they say they are.
Where are those keys, Rose?
You know I can't give you the keys, right, babe?
Rose's brother Jeremy knocks Chris out, and he awakens strapped to a chair in a den, where he's forced to watch a video about a procedure to insert a white person's brain into a healthy black body.
You have been chosen because of the physical advantages you've enjoyed your entire lifetime. With your natural gifts and our determination, we could both be part of something greater, something perfect.
Chris begins scratching at the chair, but realizes something. Soon, the TV is supposed to hypnotize him to ready him for the procedure, but Chris has stuffed the chair stuffing in his ears and is fully awake. He knocks Jeremy out, then finds Dean and Missy and kills them too. Jeremy comes back, and then there's Rose to deal with, a stone-cold killer with a shotgun. Walter and Georgina, now discovered to be Rose's grandpa and grandma, try to stop Chris. Walter, momentarily taken over by his real black consciousness, kills himself. Chris tries to strangle an injured Rose, but stops. Cop lights flash in the driveway, but it's not the police. It's Chris's buddy Rod, here to take care of business. Chris and Rod pull away to safety as Rose dies alone in the road.
I love even you reading that is suspenseful. It's such a good movie.
It's a great movie. And you're like, oh yeah, that's a great fucking plot, dude. Okay, so this is something that I wanted to start off with, is that Jordan Peele was talking about his process of trying to get this character, who's his main character, who's black, to be someone who white audiences would identify with, mm-hmm. right? Because that was his instructive, is just like try to get someone that they'll identify with. But he had a kind of awakening as he was doing this. He said, quote, "I thought I'd lose black people because we're victims in the movie and that's hard to watch. That's not fun. Maybe I'd lose white people because white people are the villains in the movie. That would be an assault. But I stuck with it. And one of the most fulfilling and validating things to see was how an audience would sort of go in with their different preconceived notions on what the film was. But by the middle, they were all Chris. They were all the main character." And there was something about him in that process that he realized that it's okay to have that very singular and very specific point of view that was his, that he was writing as his main character. You know, I'm curious, you're a writer who does a lot of comic characters, mm-hmm. and obviously you do have to have some kind of endearing quality to them to kind of get the audience to come along. But what's that process like of creating that person who, even though they're really, really specific, they have to be kind of universal?
Yeah, I always try to start with a real feeling that I have. And the best ones are usually ones that you're embarrassed about or embarrassed to admit, or that thing that you're like, you've known in the back of your mind for 20 years, but when you finally say it to a girlfriend, she's like, oh my God, I do that too.
Yeah.
And so some of those things are universal to women, regardless of race, or universal to people who feel awkward or deal with anxiety or whatever. Like, there's going to be something that people can grab onto, like, regardless of race or gender, if it's like a true emotional thing.
Yeah.
And then I think there's always a sense of like a moment of like, we're all in this together, guys. Like, that moment of like, okay, you know, I'm a terrible person. Like on the Black Lady Sketch Show, there's a character I play that's the most annoying woman in the world. Like that's the name of the sketch.
Yeah.
And her thing is like she's an influencer and she cares about likes and followers.
Once again, InstaFam, I'm here in my hometown, Camp Alabama. Today, my high school's honoring my 10th grade English teacher, Mrs. Gott. So I flew first class on a bunny pass all the way from Miami, Indiana, to surprise her.
And like, as much as it's like, oh, this is super annoying, it's a character that's very different from myself, but also made of parts of myself, the part that wants likes and followers, we all have that part. So it's like having that moment where it's like, this character seems insane, but one thing that she cares about is something we're all ashamed to admit that we care about.
I would like to talk a little bit about the process of setting a tone. Because I think, obviously, this movie has a tone that is kind of walking a tightrope because you have comedy and you have very serious moments. And then you also have very scary moments. And these things all kind of work together. So here's one example of what he was doing. In the beginning, when Chris is getting ready, he said, Jordan Peele said, the Childish Gambino song was there. I needed the whole audience to understand that the lead character, Chris, is woke like the song. Mm-hmm. He's not an idiot. He's going to be making the right decisions. The song fit perfectly and was originally meant to be scored, but the score ended up being so heavy and didn't bring us this chill groove. There was a setting of that where I was actually kind of surprised that that Childish Gambino song showed up in the beginning of this movie. And I was like, oh, that's because we just don't hear these songs in horror films.
Yeah, I remember being like, oh, these are cool people. Because, like, he's getting ready and she's shopping for donuts. And the shots of her shopping for donuts are so beautiful. But you don't know, like, who they are or what their relationship is. But you're like, oh, it's Brooklyn. They're cool. These are our people. Mm-hmm. Which means woke. They're probably both woke. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, we are them is what that song said to me. Like, these are the people we are going to identify with, which, of course, is incorrect, right?
Yeah, But that's, you know, it's the mask that he's playing with, that kind of toying with, where you can kind of have a cultural signifier that says, like, I'm woke, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Yeah.
So it's a really wonderful tone that he's setting in terms of coming in with this very warm an inviting song, and I love the use of music in this. We'll get further into that later on, but that particular moment and him deciding to not do a score and him deciding to have it be a mellower sense of just like becoming relaxed, I thought was a really ingenious move.
Yeah, I like that. At Second City, we have a thing that we call like close to self, and basically at the beginning of the show, you want your actors to be playing characters that are kind of like them, heightened versions of them, so that later, when they're playing these super crazy characters, it's more impressive because you know where they started. Whereas if the first thing you see is someone acting like a lunatic, you're like, oh, maybe this actor's a lunatic, you know? And so it's interesting. I feel like the beginning of this movie is like, it's very comfortable for like the woke, chill people who are going to watch this movie. It's Brooklyn. It's very, okay, I know where I am. And then we go off to another world. Mm-hmm. And then we see like, why that's so different, because we experience, like, you could start this movie, ding dong, me and my boyfriend are here, you know what I mean? But setting the tone in that way is so important.
And I'm thinking about in terms of your career, where you are with Black Lady Sketch Show, because when you guys are doing this, like, you had to, you get to announce that this is a very black show.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an opportunity to kind of set that tone and be like, here are the inside jokes that we're going to do for our crowd. And then if people get it, then like come along. And there's like it's a really great and rare opportunity, I would think, to get to do that. I'm thinking even in terms of there's that sketch, Hertep.
Congrats to the newlyweds, Kwame and my beloved baby sister, who still embraces her devil name, Hannah. See, Hannah reduces to ha and na. Ha, being the laughter of all pretzels, and nah, she shouldn't be using that name.
Oh, Lord.
It's something that I think not everyone's going to get, but they're going along because they want to learn.
Yeah, and like not even all black people. Like my mom was like, that was hilarious. What's a hotep? And I was like, I'm so happy you don't know.
Like, first off.
My mom is not extremely online. But yeah, it's like if jokes are solid and well-constructed, they'll hit even if you don't know what the specific is of the detail in the joke. And then sometimes there are jokes that you're just not going to get if you're not in on them. But I think like the show is beautiful. It's fun. There aren't a lot lot of those. There will be something for you 5 seconds later. It's like a very layered show. But there is something on a lot of the work that I've done, when I am able to represent blackness, which isn't all the time, it's a translation, and the white audience is assumed. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to like push back on that and be like, black people watch this show too. We can do one joke for them. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, hopefully lots of different people are watching the show, but the audience that people are envisioning is white. And so anything that you say about your experience, you kind of have to translate for them. And the joy of not having to do that as a creator on Black Lady Sketch Show is amazing. But I think there's also a joy for the audience of not having that done for them all the time. Because, you know, like we were talking about earlier about identifying with a main character, we as women identify with male main characters the majority of the time, and we're fine. You know what I mean? It's still a pleasurable process. And sometimes you learn things, like I've learned things writing male characters that, like, I didn't know. And it's great to know that, and it's enjoyable and pleasurable.
Yeah.
I think it can be pleasurable to identify with a character who's not like you, but I think a lot of times shows don't give people the chance to do that. They ask that black writer, that black actor, whatever, to translate their experience for you instead of trusting you to just like get in and come along for the journey.
We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit more about tone stuff, about using cliches to your advantage, about looking to classics for inspiration, and a whole bunch more. So we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Fireside Chat on KMAX. With me in studio to take your calls is the dopest duo on the West Coast, Oliver Wong and Morgan Rhodes. Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm looking for a music podcast that's insightful and thoughtful, but like also helps me discover artists and albums that I've never heard of.
Yeah, man. Sounds like you need to listen to Heat Rocks. Every week, myself and I'm Morgan Rhodes and my co-host here, Oliver Wong, talk to influential guests about a canonical album that has changed their lives.
Guests like Moby, Open Mike Eagle, talk about albums by Prince, Joni Mitchell, and so much more.
Yo, what's that show called again?
Heat Rocks, deep dives into hot records.
Every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Ashley Nicole Black and also her dog, Gordy. You might hear in the background a few jingle jingles. Very enthusiastic guest.
She's running around, just enjoying the studio.
She's, you know, we're going to get her interview later on. She's got a lot of thoughts.
Yeah, I don't think she liked Get Out as much, I will say. It was scary music. I'm getting nervous. She's like, I don't know if I like this.
Yeah. Why is this happening to her? Why are we doing this?
Watch something happier.
She's doing this willingly. So one of the things I promised over the break that we talk about is looking to classics for inspiration. Jordan Peele said, quote, "It's a great way to learn how to reinvent modern ideas. Stylistically, Get Out is a throwback to the 60s, one of my favorite times for film. They really knew how to wind tension tighter and tighter." And you know, obviously people tend to stop at the 70s kind of, but he prefers to go back to the 60s and even back to like the 50s and before that. That's something that I appreciate in directors who are looking for vision and trying to rewrite those histories. But I think it seems to me, if I'm, you know, I was a big Key and Peele fan too. I think he just does that with everything. I don't think it was just Get Out. I think it was just everything. Because if you look at Key and Peele, I mean, he's really kind of reinventing old jokes with new spins on them where you're like, oh, I think I know what the setup is going to be. And then that setup is not
that.
What you thought it was going to be. And you know, again, I love that reinvention. And so, you know, I'm curious about for you, what is your relationship with older material and in using that in your own work?
Yeah, I think like the sort of classic structure of a joke is like you have a shared expectation and then it's broken. Mm-hmm. So anytime you can create shared expectation by using something that people think they know what it is, it makes your job a little bit easier. So like on a Black Lady Sketch Show, there's a sketch on my own. And the premise of the sketch is like my character, every time she breaks up, Patti LaBelle shows up at her house and sings to her, which is a strange thing to get people on board.
Yeah.
It's a lot to explain. And usually in sketch, you have 3 lines of dialogue to explain what's happening.
Yeah.
And it's a lot. So what I tried to do with that script is the lines at the very beginning where they're breaking up. It's the most cliche breakup you've ever heard. So the audience doesn't have to spend any time going like what's happening. Like at one point there was a discussion on our show, Women Play Men, quite a bit. Should we have a woman playing that boyfriend character?
Yeah.
And it was like, in that case, no, because if you have to spend time thinking, okay, there's a woman on screen. Is she playing a man? Is she playing, or is it a lesbian relationship? By the time you figure that out, Patti LaBelle is here and you're like behind on the sketch.
Yeah.
So it's a man and a woman, a very, very cliche breakup, so that you're like, okay, I know what's oh, this is obviously two people breaking up because I've heard these lines before. Mm-hmm. So then when Patti LaBelle comes, you can focus your energy on like, oh, what's she doing here? Mm-hmm. And not what's happening in the sketch.
So you're condensing visual information.
Yeah.
For the quickest. I mean, and it's, I wouldn't say like all audiences are dumb. I mean, we are.
No, but like, I don't think, not because the audience is dumb, but just because it, we don't have time for that. Like yeah. In a sitcom, you have time to figure out, oh, these are not two women who are in a relationship. This is a woman playing a man. And like, I always think about dramas. They spend so much time on visual information. Yeah. In a drama, that would be like my character looking out the window and it's raining. Okay, now I know she's sad. And Oh, there's a man here. He's packing his bag. He puts his Nintendo in the bag. He must be going for good.
Yeah.
And now we've had 2 minutes of screen time before we've gotten into anything, but we know what's happening. In sketch, we have 2 seconds to do that much work. So you kind of, instead of doing all of that visual work, are just like, I'm telling you exactly what's happening. Get on board because it's about to change.
You know, I would say if I'm tying this back to Get Out too, because it's actually pretty easy to do. There's so much information, seeing this on later things, so much information is conveyed in that first 20 pages. And when you're writing a feature script, that is something that is, you know, obviously we talk about like that first 20 pages, that first act. It's the place where all of your foundation is, and hopefully all of your information is contained in that if people go back and look. And very much everything. I was actually surprised at how quickly the story moved when I was watching it again. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, they're already on their way to the house. Like, it happens so quick.
Yeah. And it's also, I feel like, such a great use of Rel, who I think is brilliant in this movie, and it's such a great character, where he's very early in the movie is like, they're going to make you a sex slave.
Yeah.
And because he's a comic relief character, you just laugh at it the first time and don't realize that, like, he told you what's happening in the movie.
Yeah. I'm thinking about in terms of so the beginning of Get Out was actually, we talk about how the end was different, but the beginning of Get Out was actually written completely different as well. But he had to change it for some budget concerns and things. I'm drawing a blank on what the original beginning of the film was, but it wasn't Lakeith Stanfield talking on the phone and getting abducted. It was something much more complicated and complex. And to me, that kind of brings to the mind the fact of like, maybe he felt like he had to write that to get to the rest of the movie. And then you go back in and you're like, this is actually simpler than what I thought it was.
And that's almost always the case.
Yeah. The thing that he said about this movie is that obviously it was his directorial debut, so it was extremely difficult and grueling for him. And he said, it was rigorous. I'm an actor, too. It was the hardest part of making the film and also the most rewarding. I know what it feels like to act. It's a very difficult and draining experience. So as a director, I wanted to give every actor their own custom-made dream process. Everybody has a different approach. I wanted them to be able to work in a way that would work best for them. And that, to me, I think is grueling.
Yeah. I can't imagine. Like, as you're reading that, I'm like, I don't even know what that would look like. Like, I can't imagine what that means on any given day.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful goal. I don't know how one would achieve it.
It's like, okay, this is what you need. And then him having the sensitivity to recognize what that is. Therefore, for instance, I told you we were going to talk about Lil Rel Howery, and this is where that comes in. He said, quote, every time Rel does the scene, he gets better. If you don't have what you need, you can just say, do another one. And he outshines your expectations. As the scene goes on, you'll notice, and this is where he's like trying to do his sleuthing work, you know? Mm-hmm. As that scene goes on, you'll notice he gets sweatier. Dude got sick in the middle of the day, got a fever, and had to go home, but it actually works for the character. And then he said, Rel's process is he's really funny reading my lines, but if I ever just said, do it in your voice, get into your stand-up line and play with it, he would just come up with some amazing details. Like, that's Jeffrey Dahmer business was not in the script.
Yeah.
And, you know, he points out throughout the commentary all the things that Lil Rel Howery came up with. And you just have such an appreciation of him as a performer, and also as of Jordan Peele as a director, to have that patience to let this performer get to what he needs and to recognize that he's a stand-up and that he needs to do it in his own voice.
I was going to say that's the thing that comes from working with comics, because some of your favorite actors that are comedic actors are not good at a script, you know, but if they put the script down and improvise their way through the scene, it'll be the best thing you've ever seen.
Yeah.
But for a director who maybe hasn't worked with that kind of actor, that would be very frustrating, because you sort of have to trust that they are going to get there, which, you know, if you come out of the comedy world, and maybe you don't, if you don't. So I do think that, like, him as a comic bringing that to directing is, like, really exciting and interesting, because I've watched a lot of people as they go from, like, stand-up or sketch on stage into film and television have that kind of stutter step where it's like, oh, the way you work is different. Mm-hmm. And it's not nobody's wrong, but it's just, like, a very different way of acting and of working.
Yeah. I know that you direct, because you directed something that I've seen, but how do you feel like you work with people?
I, like, am not a director. Any time that I've directed, it's been under duress.
You chose to do it.
No, I mean, there's also, like, on Full Frontal, you sometimes show up to set and it would be really quiet. You'd be like, hey, who's directing? They'd be like, you. And you're like, oh, okay.
Oh, shit. Okay. All right.
I guess it's me. So I try to treat everyone like a genius, and assume that, you know, the person who's doing costumes, the person who's doing makeup, each actor is a genius at what they do. And there's no way I could possibly know all of the things that they know about their part of the process. Mm-hmm. And my job is to protect the entirety of the process and create an environment where everyone can do their thing, but not to tell anyone how to do that thing. Mm-hmm. And I think as an actor, I mean, exactly what Jordan said, like, trying to know people's styles. So, like, myself, I come from a stage background. I'm a ham. I get better when more people are watching.
Okay.
There are some actors who would prefer, like, a more closed set. They don't want to see a lot of people acting. There are some, I've watched actors, and being a stage person, I don't understand this, but I've seen enough of them doing it to know it's, like, a real actor thing. Mm-hmm. Well, they'll kind of, like, slide into the line and out of it because they know where you're going to cut. So it's okay if they're doing something different on the two sides of it because they know where it's going to cut. Like, a stage actor is doing it exactly the way it would be performed live and not thinking about cut points. And so it's just knowing that, like, neither of those are wrong. You can cut them both together, like, just as easily, and allowing people to have their process instead of expecting them to conform to what you think the process is, which I think is probably even harder for performers turned directors, because you're like, I know how to do it. And you have to remember, I know my way of doing it, but there's 100 great ways to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about, working with some of these actors, specifically Daniel Kaluuya, who, you know, delivered some really emotional performances, but also just the idea of putting some of the trickier moments on the page. So we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Joe Firestone.
And I'm Manolo Moreno.
And we're the hosts of Dr. Game Show, which is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, regardless of quality or content, with in-studio guests and callers from all over the world.
And you can win a custom magnet.
A custom magnet.
Subscribe now to make sure you get our next episode.
What's an example of a game, Manolo?
Pokemon or medication.
How do you play that?
You have to guess if something's a Pokemon name or medication.
Medication.
First time listener, if you want to listen to episode highlights and also know how to participate, follow Dr. Game Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We'd love to hear
from
you.
It's really fun.
For the whole family, we'll be every other Wednesday starting March 13th, and we're coming to Max Fun!
Snorlax.
Pokemon?
Yes.
Nice.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Ashley Nicole Black, and we're talking about Get Out. I got to give a shout out to Gordy, too. Jingle, jingle, jingle. One actor who people maybe don't remember, or, you know, she just had a small role, it's actually the policewoman who comes in at the end. And he had something to say about that I thought was really interesting, because apparently the policewoman that they wrote was just flat.
The FBI.
Yeah, the FBI agent. Just really flat. Didn't have any character or anything. Just was like, okay, like this is the procedural. This is what they'll do. But the actor brought extreme depth is what he felt. And he was like, oh, okay, I really have to cast her. He said, quote, the scene is meant to give us a break and a safe space. I didn't want to tell any jokes. I just wanted it to be what it would be in real life, which is a dead end. So he didn't feel comfortable infusing that with any like laugh lines. But the thing is that the way that this woman, this actress interpreted it, turned it up a little bit and had heightened reality of it. And even just that blandness or the mundanity of it was enough to make it funny in itself. We're just like, she's a blank slate. She's, you know, like she was doing a great performer job, but she only has a bit part. And I really want to talk about those actors who have small parts, who are like, don't even have names, but they come in and they just kill it.
Yeah, because that's Erica Alexander, right?
Yes.
And then even the two guys that come in, they're only there to like laugh at her. And they're fantastic.
They're stage actors as well, I think.
Yeah.
Right?
I feel that. Yeah, they're great. Yeah, it's also a weird like double consciousness thing that I don't know how intentional this is, but this was how I interpreted it. Erica Alexander is like beloved by Black audiences. And so as soon as you see her on screen, you're like, ooh, she's here. But like for white people, they're like, I don't know who she is. And this is obviously a small part and she's not important, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like two very different experiences where like as soon as I see Rel and Erica Alexander sitting across the table from each other, I'm like, oh, something hysterical is about to happen, which I think is not what is happening on the page at that point of the script. But yeah, it's like that sort of rewarding an audience who knows to know that.
I want to get into something else that wasn't on the page for Get Out and that he that Jordan Peele got through performance. And that is Betty Gabriel's moment. Mm-hmm. And Betty Gabriel, an undersung hero of this film, sells a lot of things because, quote, her performance here sums up the entire movie. And Jordan Peele is talking about that moment where the tear falls from her eye. To continue, he said, it had to be creepier than anything before it. All I told Toby, his cinematographer, was this scene needs to feel more menacing, more in your face. And Toby picked the lens. No was her key word to try to reel in the woman's soul. And I just said, do it as much as you want. The more you say it, the creepier it is. And she chose apparently like 8 or 9 times that she said it. But that was his direction, was just like, all it said was no on the page, right? And this is the scene that you get. And it's very different than what you see on that page. It is striking. There's almost no way that you can explain what he's going to get spontaneously from that moment and from Betty Gabriel.
All I know is sometimes, but if there's too many white people, I get nervous, you know?
Oh, no. Aren't you something?
Yeah, that moment is iconic. One of the things that's interesting to me about it is, and not being a person who understands cinematography at all, she is one of the most beautiful women in the world. And however they've chosen to frame her in that moment makes her look strange. Mm-hmm. And so it's already like something has shifted just in the way they're framing it. Mm-hmm. And then to me, that moment would be terrifying as an actor. Like, how do you play something that's, first of all, never happened to a human being, two brains fighting each other in your brain? Mm-hmm. That is what's happening to you. But the audience can't know that yet. So you have to be fully playing that, but also in a way that's like not so obvious that we'll know it on first viewing of the scene. Mm-hmm. And you have one word. It's not like he gave a monologue where she's like, shut up, brain. You know?
She said, right? No.
Yeah,
that's
you have
it.
One word to get that work done on. I don't know how you achieve it.
I did an interview with her before, and I just fucking love her, like, as a performer. All the actors that they cast in this was just, like,
all outstanding.
Where the fuck did you find? Everyone is just, like, very trained, like, theatrically, mm-hmm. and, like, can do comedy and drama. They're just the most talented cast that they could find.
And all kind of in parts you wouldn't normally see them in.
Yes.
Like, everyone all very actors that are very familiar to us, but surprising in this movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, because some of them are people who work in TV. For instance, the gentleman who plays Walter, his name is Marcus Henderson, and he had a really amazing audition, apparently, where he came in and, you know, he'd been playing like police officers and things on TV a lot, you know, like a lot of the kind of procedural thing that you get for, which is what Betty Gabriel said to me in the interview too, where she was just like, yeah, we're going to play a lot of cops on TV.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to get. You know, you're a strong actor, so you can present a strong force. And so that's going to be, you know, what you're going to.
Yeah,
get.
I did a workshop once where they tell you, like, what your type is.
Oh, shit.
And the sad thing is I didn't even get cop. I got, like, junior cop, assistant, nurse, not doctor. I was like, oh, I'm not even professional black. I'm an assistant black.
You don't even get to play the judge?
Yeah, no.
You're like, oh, I'm so sorry. Assistant black.
But that's how pinned in, I think, actors in general, but particularly black actors are, that not even, I mean, cop is so restrictive to tell someone this is what your career is going to be.
Yeah.
But like junior cop, that's how restrictive it can be.
Yeah. I think Marcus Henderson and the way that Jordan Peele describes his audition, I think, is really lovely because they had an idea of what they wanted these grandmother and grandfather characters to be. But he added something a little extra to it. In his improvisations, he started improvising very almost like Joe Biden-y, old-timey, old white man language. And it was something like really studied and rehearsed. And he said, apparently, he improvised that top of the line.
She is lovely, isn't she?
Rose?
Here she is.
One of a kind. Top of the line. A real doggone keeper.
And Jordan Peele said, I said, you gotta say that again. It's so weird and old and creepy. And so he just brought in this extra level of like what he thought the character was going to be. Mm-hmm. And again, these are two characters who are not large in the film, but if you get a chance to maybe play something that you don't get to play, you're gonna do your research, right? Do you do research on any of the people that you're doing, or what do you?
Yeah, I tend to mostly have acted in things I've written, so I'm going to research
just
it,
like,
when I'm writing it.
I just,
it.
Like, wrote most of it, so.
That's what you have to do when no one wants to cast you. So some of that character research happens in the writing stage.
Yeah.
And what I try to do is to write as if another actor is going to play the part, because if I wrote thinking about myself, I would limit myself to what I'm comfortable doing or know I know how to do. So I do all my research and do a regular writing process like someone else is going to do it. And then when it comes to acting time, I sort of put all that away and do scene work again as an actor. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes figure out exactly how I've screwed myself and how I have to figure out how to play this part.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to kind of jump gears a little bit away from the acting stuff and a little bit more into kind of writing and topical things, because I thought that something that Jordan Peele said was very interesting to me and something that I agree in. He's talking about reacting to your environment when you create something. And again, like, I mean, I guess this does tie into research of just like, well, I'm going to write something that maybe is topical for right now, that's on people's minds. It's a quote, I do think that when any horror movie hits its stride, really resonates, it's because it's playing to some real fear in the zeitgeist. That's how the torture porn genre became big in the post-9/11 era. Saw, Hostel, The Human Centipede. Mm-hmm. That was us exercising this demon within us. We were out for blood. This is true for both horror and comedy. If they work, it's because there's some kind of social truth. And obviously this is a guiding principle, I think, for all of his work. And it's served him quite well. And I was curious about your thoughts on that and how you employ that in your own life.
Yeah, it's funny because we were reading the first half of the quote about horror. I was like, oh, that's true of comedy, too. So it is like taking that real fear, and sometimes they're very small things, and heightening them to dramatic effect. So like on the on my own sketch that we did on a Black Lady sketch show. Mm-hmm. It's a real thing that you experience, which is when you have a breakup, you have that song that you play that makes you cry every time until mm-hmm. you have, like, for me, myself, sometimes when something is real happening in my life, I can't cry about it because I'm, like, holding myself back and being stoic. So I'll either play that song or watch a certain Grey's Anatomy episode to sort of trick myself into the crying I need to do. Sure. And then just heightening that to the point of, like, the artist is actually there in the room. Mm-hmm. Or, like, that moment you mentioned in Get Out where, like, everyone's quiet and they just sort of listen and it's the creepiest thing. A very real Black fear is, what are white people doing when we're not in the room? Mm-hmm. And I, like, have always had this fear. Like, the second I leave the room, they just all scream the N-word together and they're so happy to, like, be free. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, this is very real. The idea that, like, as soon as I leave the room, their behavior changes and I don't know because I don't see it is a real fear. And then, of course, in the horror movie, it's heightened to the point where, like, yes, they actually are all working against you, which, of course, we know in real life is not true. And we stop ourselves from taking it that far. We're cutting ourselves off from ever thinking that because it's, like, a rude, bad thing to think. So we can sort of have the enjoyment and catharsis of watching it in a horror movie. Mm-hmm. Like, what would it really be like if that little nagging fear in the back of your mind that every time you leave the room, this thing is happening, what if it really was happening?
Yeah, again, it's a different kind of exercising demons. Mm-hmm. And I think, obviously, that's something that is both a personal and kind of cultural zeitgeisty thing that is happening, where he's tapping into things that are happening on a larger scale globally, but then also things that he's feeling very personally. Mm-hmm. And that's, do you feel like you have to catch things in that zeitgeist, like get things done before, like write about them before they leave the zeitgeist ever?
Some things, especially like writing for a show like Full Frontal, you're writing the news of that week. Once that week is over, it's no longer
We don't know
currency.
What the fuck happened last week. I have no idea.
Especially in this current news cycle.
This post-Trump. Yeah.
Oh, so, yes. But also, I feel like anytime I feel that, like when I'm not on a show and I'm like, oh, I have this really funny idea. I wish I could film a sketch really fast. And I'm like, actually, if I have to film it really fast for it to make sense, maybe it's not the best idea. Mm-hmm. Because those universal ideas sort of ring true no matter what is happening pop culture wise.
Yeah. And I can see that in terms of a Black lady sketch show is something that could have an ephemeral quality, but I see it has lasting staying power with it. I wanted to thank you for coming on the show today. Our hour is up.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for bringing Gordy and thank you for bringing all of her joy. And please tell us when people can see a Black lady sketch show and what's coming up for it.
It's on streaming now if you want to watch season one, and we are very quickly getting into season two. So.
And do you have anything else that you want to plug? I mean, this is the time.
Yeah, I'm also writing on Bless This Mess, which is on ABC. Mm-hmm. That's coming back next week, I think. And yeah, you can always find me on Twitter, Instagram. If you want to see the Gordy you've been hearing running around the studio, she's on Instagram.
She's beautiful. She's gorgeous. She's worth
it. She's very attractive. Chunky dog.
Oh, thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
How foolish of me.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.